if none of them work, then no one can say I didn't try. All right. So there were three questions, as you recall. The first one was compulsory. It was discuss the transcriptional control of the Hox gene clusters in Drosophila and mouse, describe that experimentation, indicating the evolutionary conservation of regulatory elements. So, you know, the discuss the transcriptional control of the Hox genes was kind of a pretty kind of an open-ended beginning to that question. Just meant that you needed to talk about the anterior, posterior pattern of expression of the Hox genes and the fact that it's sort of roughly conserved between Drosophila and mouse. And then the experimentation side of it were those mix and match, you know, kind of swap experiments that we talked about, where they took the regulatory elements from the Drosophila gene, put it into the mouse, it still drives expression in the same region as the anterior region of the Drosophila, and vice versa. So if you describe that experimentation and, you know, just the bare bones of it in terms of how we discussed it in class, then you would get, you know, pretty decent marks on that. So here, I'm not going to read this out because I know that you can all read. So I'll just let you read through that. It gives you the bare bones of what we talked about in class, and if you got all that in your answer in some kind of reasonably coherent fashion, you would get 8 marks, 8 out of 10, or an 8, 80%. If you wanted to be an A-plus student, which in my mind is an 85 or a 90 and above, then as I've put down the bottom here, you know, there are a couple of possibilities for getting extra marks, actually 3 in theory. So you could have the possibility of getting 11 out of 10, although I told the marker not to give you more than 10 out of 10 if you got them all. So that was the general mark scheme for question 1. In general, it was done pretty well. Some of you didn't describe the experimentation, and that was why some people went a little awry with that question. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on this or debate it a lot. That's the marking scheme that we had. So the second question, the optional questions, 2 and 3. 2 was the sort of Drosophila dorsal question. By and large, it was done very well. I think that was probably because we literally just covered it in class and it was sort of fresh in your minds. And so, in general, that was done well. Those of you who chose question 3, that was a bit more variable in terms of the responses, and that was the one talking about transcriptional control. So, post-transcriptional control. So let's look then at the answer that I generated, first of all, for... Okay, so this is the post-transcriptional control. It doesn't matter, they're in the wrong order. So the full question was, give 2 examples of post-transcriptional control of gene expression during development. Illustrate your answer with a description of experiments that elucidate the type of control you have described. So it's asking you for 2 examples of post-transcriptional control, and then describe experiments that kind of elucidate that level of control. So what we're looking for is, you know, I think it was fairly obvious that post-transcriptional, as long as you've got the level right, you know, it could be localization, stability, or alternative splicing, and you get 2 if you got 2 of those 3. And then the experiments that we discussed, really, there was the GLP experiment, you know, where they showed that the 3' UTR, you know, if you look in the C. elegans embryo, drove the expression of it. So if you describe that experiment, you've got it. And the only other experiment really that we looked in terms of post-transcriptional control with astaxanthin mutants in Drosophila, you know, would show that if you delete astaxanthin, you get mislocalization, right? So I think the reason why some of you struggled in that was because you didn't have an experiment to elucidate the level of control. So if you talked about alternative splicing, you know, you would have to know an experiment that showed that, right? And we hadn't really talked about one. So to me, that was where people lost some marks on that question, because you couldn't describe an experiment that elucidated the control. But in general, you know, it was fine. So where are we now, you know, in terms of thinking about some of you thinking about the drop date being Friday? I would say, you know, if you got an 11 or a 12, I know that doesn't translate to a great percentage point, you know, in terms of the grading scheme. But if you got an 11 or a 12 on this midterm, you're pretty safe, you know, because as long as you do a decent job with your essay, you know, usually people get high marks on the essay. It's just about getting to it early and making sure that you do a good job on it. So that, you know, corresponds to 30% of the marks. And then usually people who have gone through the midterm process, which is really critical in this course, you kind of get the way that you have to approach it. And usually people do better in the final exam because there's more choice, you're a bit more comfortable with all of the material. So they generally do better in the final than they do on the midterm, which is worth 40%. So all told, you know, I think if you're 11 or 12 and up at this stage, I think you're safe. It might not be good enough for you at this point, and that's totally up to you, but less than that, you know, it's kind of a little bit dicey. In some cases, you know, where someone does a really good job on one answer and just completely bottomed out on the other one, you're going to get a low mark because obviously it's half of the midterm, right? So it's not the end of the world, you know, because if you're able, you know, to get good marks on one of the questions, I think you can still do okay in the course. But again, that's sort of up to you in terms of how you deal with that. If you're borderline and you got, you know, 10 and below and you're not sure whether to continue, I will make time. I know I've been kind of fending off emails in the last few days because I've been busy doing other things, but I will make time in the next 2 or 3 days to make sure that I connect with you. You know, if you're on campus or by phone or by email, you know, to discuss it a little bit more if you want to do that. Okay? So, yeah.
You said that if we just want to like, see it in terms of where we went wrong, but it's not urgent,
mm-hmm.
How long should we wait?
Not long. I mean, let's just wait until after the drop, you know, which is Friday.
Okay.
You know, so next week I'll meet with you, and you can look at your papers, and, you know, my schedule is a little lighter now, too. But let's leave these next few days just for the people who are kind of feeling a bit borderline as to what to do. Okay? Yeah?
Well, essays still
need
to do on March 29th because of the
strike. Everything is you know, fluid at this point, I would say. We'll definitely, you know, we should be shooting for the usual deadlines, I think, right now. So don't treat this as a holiday, you know, and not bother doing anything. I think that's kind of pretty obvious to you guys. Even though, you know, my daughter is second year psychology, and she was kind of talking about it last night, like, oh, we're going to have a little holiday here. I'm like, no, you're not. You know. So anyway. All right. So anything else before we carry on? Yeah. No. I just said to someone a bit earlier, you know, that I don't like posting these because, you know, there are a limited number of essay-style questions that I ask over the years, and I kind of revolve them around, but it's not that I particularly don't like the idea of posting, other than I don't like people revising from answers, stock answers. You know, I know that this happened in the past, you know, and I changed one of the questions, and I said, you know, in that dorsal question, instead of having a null mutant, I said, what happens in a constitutively active mutant? And because the people had all already studied the answer to the question, they just wrote out what happened in the null mutation, which was, of course, you know, hopeless. So I think it's always better to learn from first principles and address what's in the there, not address, you know, not regurgitate answers that you've seen before. It's kind of wild. Yeah.
Is there a second question after?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sorry, I didn't.
So those are the. Yeah, so that's the, you know, the GLP-1 experiment that you should have probably got, right? And then the Stauffer mutant is there, but that's sort of what I was expecting for the dorsal answer. This was pretty much straightforward. You just needed to know the pathway, right? You needed to know what snake was doing in it, and then what happened if it was null. I should mention too that, you know, there's always a little bit of subjectivity associated with short essay style answers, and you'll always be given the benefit of the doubt in that whenever I mark them, and I told the marker that too. She took the course a few years ago, so she knows this course. So you know, nothing's totally written in stone with essay style questions, and especially at the end of the course, I'm always reviewing, you know, people's overall contributions when I'm figuring out the final grade. So that's important too. Okay. Yeah.
So I noticed for the compulsory question, there was a little extra marks. Is that only for compulsory questions?
No, it's actually there for the others too. So my general view is, if you're a good student and you know kind of the concepts and you understand what we've talked about in class, and you can use that information and address the question and nothing more, but you do it coherently. I mean, that to me is, you know, it's a kind of borderline A. It's an 80. But if you want to be an A-plus student, you know, you've got to go just a little bit beyond that. So if you had a little bit of extra information from a paper, from the textbook that is pertaining to the question, you know, that's worth an extra mark to me. And also there's an extra mark to be had for a well-written answer. You know, so if I read something, I thought, oh, that's, you know, that's nicely laid out and coherently, you know, put forward, then I give you an extra mark for sure.
So that's the discretionary mark, right?
Yeah. But also there are discretionary marks everywhere, because if somebody comes up with a totally different answer but addresses the question, it's okay. You know, you still get marks for it. So, you know, and the marker has the, you know, knows that if there's something that's completely different, she flags it, and I look at it to see whether it's relevant to the question. If it is, you'll get marks for it. You know, for something like post-transcriptional, you know, if you were working on that for your honors thesis, or you know, you read something else and it was still valid, then that's perfectly okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just for the first question, like you were saying about the information is not an answer, like so often you want,
yeah.
There isn't an answer, you didn't have a whole hierarchy of the polarity genes and heritability problems, which are all the same for regulation.
Yeah, so what's your question?
Associated with those would get extra marks.
It has to be relevant. you have to be careful not to delve into the region of just writing everything you know. So as long as it's appropriate for the question, you would get marks. Okay. All right. Let's move on. What am I doing with all this technology now? I don't know. Keyboard has to be the most difficult thing to operate that was ever designed. Okay. Okay, so let's begin here. Just by, first of all, summarizing sort of where we got to in terms of this topic of neurulation last time. And clearly, it's a topic of massive interest. You know, how do you develop and pattern the central nervous system in a higher vertebrate? It's quite a phenomenal area that I've never really studied in any depth, you know, but you can see the appeal of it. You know, as I said to you last time, the spinal cord and brain, you know, it integrates all of the activities that we carry out as humans, everything from, you know, kicking a soccer ball to having an emotional response to the picket line to involuntary activities like breathing, all of this sensory activities like, you know, retracting our finger when we touch something hot. You know, this is all integrated in the central nervous system and how that actually occurs, I mean, on an intuitive level has to be, you know, one of the most fascinating things about modern biology, for sure. So, where did we get to last time? Well, we got to the point of understanding how the epiblast gives rise to the neural plate, and how that progenitor neural tissue gets sculpted into a neural tube. And just that by itself is quite a phenomenal act of cellular movements and molecular biology. So now the question is, once you've formed this cylindrical tube with a progenitor sort of status, how on earth is that going to develop into the brain and the spinal cord with all of the neurons and all of the incredible complexity within it that is required to form a functioning vertebrate? So this part then really refers to what we call the patterning of the central nervous system. So here on this opening slide, I'm just reminding you of the reading, and on my notes here, I also, yeah. So I wanted you to read from page 428 to the end of that chapter 13 to 437, and it's a really nice synopsis of this topic. So here, I think I showed you this picture previously. Stick the low tech part of my lecture. So you can see this general sort of organization of the dorsal ventral axis, where we have, as we talked about, the notochord running parallel with the neural tube on the ventral side, and then the neural tube proper being specified in terms of its dorsal ventral axis in specifying particular types of neurons. And in this picture, these neurons that are sort of ventrolateral to the floor plate that are colored orange give rise to the motor neurons, the alpha motor neurons that connect with our muscle tissue to allow us to move voluntarily and so on. But there are many, just to give you an idea, you know, there are many neurons that are specified in this dorsal ventral axis, as we'll see in a few minutes. And as we've seen in the past, where those progenitor cells are within gradients of signaling factors is actually what determines their identity. So it's a great kind of juxtaposition with the Drosophila situation, where we see the same thing, you know, where cells are located in morphogen gradients determines what they become. And we'll see that this is the case in the patterning of the nervous system too. Okay, so this is really just a reiteration of what we've seen before, in the sense that in the early neurulating embryo, we can see very nicely, this is a chick. We can see the primitive streak here, the neural plate in the anterior most regions, the notochord that runs just below the future neural tube. As development proceeds, we'll have the situation where the streak regresses towards the posterior, and in its wake, we leave the neural groove, which will give rise to the neural tube. So the newer part of this is depicted on this picture, where, you know, we're looking at the later development. So now we're here in a 5 somae embryo, and now we're starting to see the neural folds forming at the anterior of the neural tube, and these head structures forming too. And just to remind you again that the compartmentalization and differentiation of these tissues occurs in a head-to-tail direction, so anterior to posterior. So while you're getting some pretty massive changes in the anterior in terms of the establishment of the brain, you know, the major regions of the brain, you're still actually only closing the neural tube in the posterior end of the embryo. So head to tail development here is key to remember. And it's the same with the paraxial mesoderm as well, when we get to it in a few lectures. So what happens then once the neural tube has closed is you get this sort of ballooning out of the tissues in the anterior region. And these regions, shown on this picture in D here, figure 10.10, indicate the region that will give rise to the forebrain, the midbrain, and the hindbrain. And then the the boundary between, you know, what will become the brain itself and the spinal cord forms from a from an occlusion, if you like, of the towards the anterior sort of cranial end of the neural tube. So this is, oh, the other thing I wanted to point out is that these structures here are the otic regions that will give rise to the retina. So you get these bulges of the anterior region that give rise to the sort of visual system. So these are real pictures, and they're quite, I think they're quite beautifully depict exactly what's going on there. And that's the beauty of the chick system to allow you to visualize easily these morphogenetic events. So the next slide gives you a bit more of a breakdown of the specific brain regions and what they give rise to. So let's just walk through this because I think it's a useful slide. So here, as you could see on the previous slide there, you know, we have the forebrain, midbrain, hindbrain. If you want to, excuse me, if you want to use the classical terminology there, you can see that the forebrain is referred to as the prosencephalon. The midbrain is the mesencephalon, mesencephalon, and the midbrain, the hindbrain is referred to as the rhombencephalon. So as development proceeds, then the prosencephalon gives rise to the to two regions, two set what we call secondary vesicles, which are the telencephalon and the diencephalon, and those secondary vesicles give rise to, in the case of the telencephalon, the olfactory lobes, which give rise to smell, the hippocampus, memory, and a few other features, the cerebrum, which is associated with intelligence. The diencephalon then is going to give rise to the optic vesicle, vision, the retinal system, the epithalamus, which gives rise to the pineal gland, the thalamus itself, which is a relay center for the optic and auditory neurons, and the hypothalamus, which is involved in temperature regulation, breathing, and so on. And then the midbrain secondary vesicles will give rise to temperature regulation proper, motor control, motivation, and emotional intelligence, or emotional control, I should say. And then as you go more caudally, the rhombencephalon gives rise to these two secondary vesicles, the metencephalon and the myelencephalon, and those then give rise to subsequently to the cerebellum and the pons, which are involved in coordination of muscular movements, tracts between the cerebrum and the cerebellum, and then the medulla, which is the sort of reflex center of the involuntary systems, like the adrenergic system. So this gives you at least a bit of a roadmap as to what's happening in those early events, and you can appreciate from the specification of these adult functions just how complex this differentiation has to be to underlie all of those activities. So I wanted to point out to you here thinking now about the molecular aspects of how this kind of specification occurs. This picture here is showing you the rhombomeres, and the rhombomeres come from the rhombencephalon. These are segmented structures that form within the rhombencephalon. They're if you like, territories that specify particular types of neurons. And I made a note here, you know, each rhombomere expresses a unique combination of transcription factors that underlies unique patterns of neural differentiation. And on this picture, you can see this is just a light microscopic version. And then this is a stain with a neurofilament antibody. And the arrows here depict particular rhombomeres or actually junctions between rhombomeres. So the top arrow is between the junction between rhombomere 1 and 2. And the lower one is rhombomeres 6 and 7. So to give you an idea then, the neural crest cells from the rhombomeres will form ganglia, which are clusters of neuronal bodies whose axons form a nerve. So each rhombomere ganglion produces a different type of nerve. So for example, generation of the cranial nerves in the chick. The first neurons appear in the rhombomere 2, rhombomere 4, and rhombomere 6 regions. In the R2 ganglia, you form the fifth trigeminal cranial nerves. In the rhombomere 4, you form the seventh, which are facial, and eighth, the vestibulo-acoustic neurons. And in R6, you form the ninth, which are the glossopharyngeal cranial nerves. So this just gives you an example that within these rhombomeres, you're specifying unique patterns of gene expression that give rise to neurons of different character. So how does this all work? This part schematic and part in situ hybridization sort of illustrates the kind of patterning that you can have here. So on the left, we're looking at the usual orientation where we have the neural tube, notochord, overlying epidermis, flanking somites here. We'll see this kind of pattern repeatedly, I think, through the next few lectures. But what's depicted on this schematic is the expression pattern for these different PAX genes. So the PAX genes are a critical determinants of the patterning of the nervous system, and they're sort of an arm of HOX type genes. So when you look here then, in the dorsal neural tube, you can see expression of PAX3 and PAX7, which shows the expression pattern in the dorsal region. The red staining is NKX6.1, which is in the floor plate region, and then the green is PAX6 here. So, just as we saw in the Drosophila system, not only are the regions of those not only are the regions of expression in but also the boundaries between them. So where you have a light blue here or a yellow, it's depicting a region where there's overlap between the expression of those things. So for example, the red stain in here for NKX 6.1 and the green is patch 6, and the boundary region which is depicted yellow here for the red and green coming together, you know, is also important in specifying identity of neurons. So it's a region where both of those transcriptional regulators are expressed. So if you translate those colors then into the true specification of the neurons in this region, you can see in this sort of fade map here that you've got a whole range of transcriptional regulators that have been determined to play a role in the unique specification of these neurons. So here, you know, we're depicting a whole bunch of different interneurons, you know, the neurons that sort of communicate between, you know, within the spinal cord and also take information from the afferent sensory neurons and process it within the spinal cord. So all these interneurons, they're called V1, V2, V0, V6, V5, V4, and so on. They're all specified in these gradients of transcription factors, just as the more efferent neurons, like the alpha motor neurons that connect with skeletal muscle, are also going to be specified in a particular region, and they're specified in the more ventral region of the neural tube here. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. So this complicated Cartesian coordinate system for the expression of these transcriptional regulators is just like we saw in Drosophila for specifying different phenotypes of the segments. So it's not that dissimilar. The institute I'm showing you on the right here is a mouse 12.5 day embryo, so 20 day duration gestation in the mouse, 2021 depending, and that's about 12.5 days. So now what you're looking at here is the expression of different transcriptional regulators, ISL1 blue, FOXP1 in red, LHX3 in green, shown here and depicting this very kind of patterned expression of those regulatory factors. But the other thing I wanted to point out here is that we're not just dealing with a dorsal ventral axis specification, because at the same time we also have anterior posterior going in, just like we do in Drosophila, right? So you know, this is a snapshot at the cervical level, but obviously as you move from anterior to posterior, as we don't see it on here, but you're going to have obviously different patterns of neurons being formed. So obviously the neural tube or the spine in the lumbar region is going to give rise to different neurons and different controls to the region in the more cranial part of the nervous system. So it's a highly complex system that we're dealing with here, and really it's probably only at the beginnings of being understood. Okay, so I wanted to just turn to, still thinking about this patterning, and turn to some of the signaling events that actually specify these particular neuronal fates. And I think this has been done very nicely in the literature. So in terms of the patterning of the nervous system, these BMP molecules, bone morphogenetic proteins, are very important. And you might remember that there's a Drosophila equivalent. Anyone remember what it is? So DPP, you'll remember, is involved in dorsal ventral axis formation. In Drosophila, decapentaplegic is the Drosophila equivalent to BMP. So you can see the evolutionary conservation of these molecules and the types of regulation that they mediate. Anyway, BMP 4 and 7 are expressed and released in the epidermis. So it's the overlying epidermis that's actually signaling to the dorsal part of the neural tube to specify particular fates. And in addition to that, there's another signaling center, which we've already mentioned a few times, which is the notochord. And the key signaling molecule from the notochord is this molecule called paracrine factor called sonic hedgehog. So BMP signals to the dorsal part of the neural tube to actually establish a new signaling center within the neural tube. And likewise, on the ventral surface, sonic signals to the floor plate here to also become a signaling center. So it's almost like a relay center of that signaling. Because you remember, there's no physical connection between the notochord and the neural tube. They're kind of sealed off and separate. But it's these paracrine factors from the overlying epidermis and the underlying notochord that are beginning the patterning of the neural tube. So when this has been specified, this establishes kind of a gradient of signaling in the dorsal ventral axis. And so the signaling of BMP, which is part of this big superfamily of growth factors called TGF-beta, or transforming growth factor beta, the TGF-beta signaling from the epidermis gives rise to this signaling center, which expresses a whole bunch of TGF-beta ligands in the dorsal region of the neural tube. So BMP7, dorsalin, which is shown on this picture down here. And because the origin of the signal is in the dorsal surface, then you can imagine it just like a morphogen gradient in Drosophila. As you go more ventrally, that gradient is going to dissipate. And conversely, if you look at the sonic signal, sonic induces sonic hedgehog signaling in the floor plane, and that becomes a signaling center that then radiates ventrolaterally and up the sides of the neural tube. And so you've got these opposing gradients, and how similar is that to what we've seen before? So you've got these opposing gradients of sonic and BMP signaling, and just as in Drosophila, where cells or cell bodies, more appropriately in the nervous system, are located within those gradients determines the transcriptional regulators that they express and what they actually become. So here you can see they've indicated the gradient TGF-beta family members and the gradient of sonic hedgehog, and they're specifying in these different regions all of these different types of interneurons, motor neurons, and so on. And just to give you one final example, it's a very nice montage here showing you the expression of PAX7, PAX6, and NKX6.1, I think that is. And remember I said to you before that the boundary areas are sometimes important where there are more than one transcription factor expressed. And this boundary region that's yellow here, which is the NKX6, PAX6 overlap, is actually a region that specifies motor neurons. And that's been proven because if you eliminate that expression pattern for either one of these, then you get a failure of motor neuron formation. So really what this next slide is just depicting is kind of what we've said already, which is that where cells are in the dorsal ventral axis in relation to the concentration of sonic ranging from zero, which because sonic signaling doesn't reach up all the way to the most dorsal region of the neural tube, going all the way to, high levels in the foreplay. You can see the specification of these different structures. So foreplay, V3, interneurons, motor neurons, V2, V1, and so on. So this idea that where you are in the gradient has been around for a good while, and I think largely accepted. One of the raging debates when this kind of model came out, though, was, you know, was it sufficient to specify the full panoply of cells in the nervous system? And the general feeling was it's probably not. There has to be other mechanisms. Before I go into that, I just wanted to show you this experiment that showed sort of in a classical way, essentially, you know, just how critical the notochord is in this specification. So here's a picture of the standard situation where you have notochord, floor plate, motor neuron forming region in the ventrolateral aspect here. Now, what they did in these experiments, there were a few. The first one is, if you dissect out a chunk of the notochord, you fail to form the floor plate region. So if you lose it, you know, you lose the specification. Now thinking, so that's a loss of function experiment. Now gain of function experiments were interesting because if you take a chunk of notochord and you implant it in the flanking region, in this sort of more lateral region, you can specify another floor plane and motor neuron differentiation of the cells in that region. So this is quite a strong experiment telling you that what's coming from this tissue is definitively specifying those tissues. Because you put it up here, ordinarily it would never make a floor plate or motor neurons, but because of that experimental manipulation, it does. So it's a sort of gain of function experiment telling you that tissue is crucial in that specification. The really nice thing about this was people said, well, you know, maybe the notochord is crucial, it's no surprise, but maybe there are multiple factors coming from the notochord. So what tells us whether sonic is necessary? And what they did was to instead of planting the donor notochord into that ventrolateral region, they implanted cells that had been engineered to express sonic hedgehog. And when they did that, again, they got the same result. So that's telling you then that sonic is the factor that's required for this specification. Just press on a little bit here for another slide or two, just to make this final point. So, as I mentioned to you a minute ago, you know, the question was, are the gradients sufficient to generate all of the complexity in the nervous system? And people started to look at not only where cells were in the concentration gradient, but the duration of time. So you're looking at both a spatial and a temporal aspect of signaling here. And when they looked at this, it was quite surprising. So here's a regulatory paradigm, if you like, for the intermediate neural tube development, where sonic express it or initiates the expression of NKX2.2, OLIG2 in the more dorsal region, and inhibits PAX7, and that's why PAX7, you know, doesn't get expressed in the more ventral region. So if you accept that paradigm, then if you now take the intermediate neural tube and you expose it to different amounts of sonic, what you see at 0.5 or 2 nanomolar is a concentration dependent effect of sonic, which is what everyone predicted, right? So here the colors correspond to these factors. So where there's no sonic in that intermediate neural tube, you can see here you get PAX7. At 0.5 nanomolar, you get OLIG2, which is a marker of the ventral mesoderm cell. And then at high levels of sonic, then you get expression of NKX2.2. So that's totally predicted based on what people thought before. The interesting part of this experiment was that they took a fairly high level of sonic exposure, and they looked temporally at 6, 12, 18, and 24 hours. Now, this is where things were not quite as one would predict, because what you now see is that the period of time that you're exposed to that high level of sonic determines what the cells become. As you can probably see here, you know, at the 6 hour mark, you have only two. But if you come contrast that to 24 hours exposure, it shifted its expression pattern to NKX 2.2. So you can see here then that a constant concentration of SONIC for different periods of time, you get a different cellular outcome. So in this case then, the general idea is that the signaling within the nervous system is both a concentration dependent and a temporal dependent feature indicates the response of cells to that particular ligand. So what I want to do now, we kind of charged on a little bit with this because I didn't want to sort of end up doing half a lecture here. I've been thinking about how to organize the next lecture or two. So in the past, we would carry on here looking at things like paraxial mesoderm and so on and so forth. We talked about the signaling pathways a bit later in the course, and it's always been a problem, this, when to actually deal with that information. So years ago, I used to talk about BMP and SONIC and FGF and so on, and the pathways that they regulate at the beginning of the course. But the problem with doing that is that you end up doing a lot of signaling pathway biology without any development. So then I did it the other way around. The last couple of years I taught the course, and people said, you can't keep talking about BMP and SONIC and so on when we don't know, what the signaling pathways are. So again, we were kind of caught with that. So what I want to do this time is, having talked to you about BMP and SONIC a fair bit here, and you can actually see the developmental consequences of what they do. In the next lecture, I'll talk about BMP and SONIC signaling in terms of how they work, what the mechanics are of those signaling pathways. And we'll see if that we do any better with that this year than the way we've done it in previous years. So before we go on to talking about the next aspects of development, which will probably be mostly paraxial mesoderm from here, we'll talk about these signaling pathways and a few unique sort of developmental features of them, so that you have that kind of in mind with this material. Okay, any questions on anything before we depart? All right, very good. So. Well, one thing you can do for me is I'm going to post this lecture, if I've done everything that I should have and I'm able to convert the files. So if you can have a look at the audio file, or trying to listen to it more importantly, and just let me know by email if it's working, I'd appreciate it. I'll make sure that I post it by tomorrow midday for sure. Okay? Great. See you next time. let me do this. I don't want to mess it up. One more.
Yeah.